Hello and welcome to Landscape Photography World, the podcast for everyone passionate about landscape photography. I'm Grant Swinburne and I'll be your host on the show, talking to landscape photographers about their motivations, likes and dislikes. Serena Zenis is an Australian lens-based artist living in Iceland, known for her mission in promoting nature conservation through visual storytelling. Serena's journey extends beyond photography, encompassing roles such as author, educator and speaker. Her work, rooted in storytelling within landscapes, captures the essence of the living world, fostering a deep connection with nature. From her early days in music photography to becoming the editor-in-chief for an Icelandic publication, Serena's portfolio spans documentary, landscape and nature photography. Her diverse background includes roles as Senior Vice President for the Health and Community Services Union in Australia and a decade in mental health. Serena shares her transition from Australia to Europe, eventually settling out in Iceland, where she now lives and focuses on capturing the connection between humanity and the land through her lens. We cover her struggle with creative blocks, her approach to storytelling through photography, the evolving nature of photography as an art form, and the impact of tourism on Iceland's natural sites, along with much more. I hope you enjoy the show. G'day, Serena. Welcome to Landscape Photography World. How are you going?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's absolute pleasure. I'm really keen to talk to you about what you're doing in Iceland and what you're doing in general in your landscape photography. But why don't we start with what landscape photography is to you and how you got started in it all?
I actually started out in music photography and documentary photography. Mm-hmm. Landscapes just came along with the whole package after that. I think I saw a movie. It was The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Okay,
Yeah. So there were lots of landscapes in there from Iceland and Greenland. And so it inspired me to do a bit of traveling. And so that was maybe, I think it was over 10 years ago now. Wow. 10, 12 years ago. I don't remember when that movie came out. But I started spending a bit more time in the landscape. Then I traveled. I went to Iceland, to Finland, to Norway, and I just fell in love with the landscapes in the Nordics. And I've done a lot of traveling since. Then I moved to Europe. And since then, I've begun living in Iceland. And my whole life has been revolving around landscape photography. For me, it's all about connecting with the land. I'm trying to find a place on this planet that is mine and just learning more about who I am as a person and where I fit in this universe as a whole.
Cool. Sounds brilliant. I'd love to delve into the why Iceland and what triggered the decision. You're obviously from Australia from your accent. So
yeah.
where did that come from? I got the bit about the Walter Mitty, but how did you end up living in Iceland?
Yes, I actually started off moving to Germany first and then from Germany to the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And while I was in both of those countries, and also a little bit while I was in Australia, I was working remotely for a company in Iceland that was running photo tours, teaching photography. And so I did quite a bit of article writing on teaching photography, landscape photography in particular, but also other types of photography. And soon I was invited to move to Iceland. I think it was maybe cheaper for the company. They sponsored me to move on a working visa. And so I moved to Iceland. And then the pandemic happened and I've been stuck here ever since.
Not a bad place to get stuck, though.
Yeah.
Particularly for a landscape photographer.
Exactly, yeah. So it was actually during my first trip here in 2016 that I fell in love with the landscapes here. Mm. Actually, I fell in love with the landscapes in Norway and Finland, but Iceland seemed to be the most logical place to live at the time.
Sure.
Yeah, just Reykjavik in general was really cute. It was small, it was manageable, everybody knows everybody. Mm. And it's a nice base to visit elsewhere. So yeah, it's been a nice place to begin that photography journey. And I've been teaching here ever since. But since the pandemic, I've done a little less teaching and more teaching online remotely.
Sure. What is it that actually motivates you in your landscape photography? What is it that drives the passion behind the images?
I guess I'm searching for something. Like I said, I'm always searching for a place in this world. And when I take photographs, I really have to have that connection with the place that I'm shooting. Yep. And I do that a lot by finding my own narrative and using the landscape to tell a story. Usually that's a story in relation to how I feel about the place. Sometimes it's historical, and I can find that sort of story in any kind of landscape. Recently, I've been working on architectural landscapes, and so I've been trying to find a connection there. And that connection is less about myself and more about how we as a species, as humans, connect with our land and our environment and our planet.
Yeah, cool. So it sounds to me like you set yourself goals and projects in your photography. Is that true?
Yeah, definitely. I find it really hard to shoot when I don't have a goal. So for the past couple of years, I've had a bit of a creative block. And I think that's just because I've lost sight of a goal, which I've been really trying to work on. Yeah. When I set out to shoot, like when I visit a new place, I always have a goal in mind about what I want to do there.
So talk to me. I normally ask this question a bit later, but you've brought up the issue of having a creative block. How have you dealt with that? You said you've had it for some time. What's that like and how have you dealt with it?
It's awful. It's it's one of the most awful feelings I've ever had. It's really depressing, actually, because you feel so useless. And I think as a photographer, sometimes you identify completely as a photographer, especially when it's something that you do professionally. And when you can't do it, it leads a lot to imposter syndrome and feeling like you're losing a sense of worth. And especially when there's other stuff going on in life that takes away your time to be able to focus on photography as well. For me, it's been a culmination of not having enough time, personal life getting in the way, family things, health issues in conjunction with that creative block. So it's been a process. I've been trying to inspire myself in other ways with other art forms, spending time looking at other people's work as well, going to galleries, exploring other artists. And that's been quite inspirational in itself. Also talking with other photographers and even other people who are just artists who have nothing to do with photography. Yeah. That in itself has been quite inspiring. There's one person in particular who I call my muse, my friend Deanna. We talk a lot about our creative process, and it's not necessarily to do with photography, but it has inspired me to branch out and to maybe look at different avenues in which I might be able to progress my photography while I'm not actively taking photos.
Sure.
That's been fantastic.
Awesome. I think it's really important to have somebody that you can bounce ideas off, even whether you call them a muse or just a friend.
Yeah.
That process, what's that been like with Deanna? Has it been something that's come easy or is it something that you've had to push a little bit for?
Yeah, it's certainly something that has been difficult to begin with. I think in the beginning it was a lot of her encouraging me and me feeling a little bit negative about it all. It was just trying to get out of that mindset of I'm worthless and my photography is going nowhere, because it's the opposite. My photography is going somewhere. I'm just not following with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just had to get myself back onto that train of actually feeling like I was going somewhere. And yeah, so we talked a little bit about what I could do that wasn't necessarily taking pictures, but would help to progress that career path. And so I've been doing a lot more work around the business side of things.
Yeah,
just admin stuff, business stuff. And that's coming to fruition now. It's been quite successful. So yeah, it's been
great. Awesome. That's great. In terms of the role of personal expression in your photography? How do you look at a place and then start to infuse your own style and vision on that place in what you're doing?
I think that the way I look at a place, and particularly my style, I have a style, a blanket style to, mm-hmm. with my photography. It's quite surrealistic. The colors are pale. I have a style that I follow. And yep. when I look at the landscape, I am already thinking in that sense how it's going to look. And in that sense, I look for subjects that will fit my narrative. Usually before I go into a landscape, I've already got a story, and it's about making that story fit. But sometimes when I take photos, I end up with a bunch of photos and then the story comes afterwards. And that's usually what happens with my architectural work as opposed to my pure landscape work.
Yeah. Okay. So talk to me a bit about that architectural work that you've been doing. It's clear from the images that I've seen on your website that you, and this is my interpretation, and I'd love to get yours and what you're thinking about it. But it seems to me that what you're looking at is man's impact on the landscape in terms of the architecture and the structures that they're building. Some of the images are around very industrial sites and things that a lot of people would either think are quite ugly or quite not a typical landscape subject. What is it about them that's making you, that's drawing you towards them?
I think the thing about living in Iceland is the human impact on the environment becomes a lot more evident than when you live in a country surrounded by industry. A lot of people come here for landscape photography and they only focus on the vast, beautiful glaciers, black sand beaches,
all the waterfalls, etc.
Yeah, waterfalls. But they don't necessarily see that industrial impact. And having lived here for 6 years, almost 7 years now, I've noticed in our day-to-day lives the impact that we're having on that environment, not just tourism, but locals and also the economy.
Mm.
We have aluminium smeltering here. We have all sorts of industry. And those, the buildings that I'm focusing on, and to see those structures within the landscape that is still really beautiful.
Yeah.
The pictures have mountains in the background, sky. It's really eye-opening to see it in that context. And what I wanted to do with those images is to not just draw attention to it, but to make it feel otherworldly, make it feel like it's not somewhere that we live. Oftentimes people don't recognize it as a place that we live anyway, because they don't know what Iceland looks like. So it does look like another planet. But the whole narrative around that series of images is not just the human impact on Earth, but what we might do to another planet if we were to travel to another planet, if we were to colonize somewhere else in the universe. We start off with a pristine landscape. We put our excavators into it. We build our structures and we try to live on this planet. Mm. How will we affect that planet? And that's what I wanted to, the question that I wanted to ask with this series.
Right, fantastic.
And thinking about that narrative and that storyline has really affected how I've processed those images and also taken those.
Cool. You mentioned telling a story and sometimes having the story before you start taking the images, and sometimes it's the opposite way around and you're getting that. With the ones that you're thinking about before you go out, those stories that you want to tell, how are you coming up with that story and that concept? I'm really fascinated about people's way of thinking about things, and whether it's that moment in the shower or while doing the dishes or whatever it is that your head just explodes and goes, oh, that's it. Is that the way it is for you, or is it something more considered? How does it work for you?
I think it's always a little bit different. I've always been a bit of a writer since I was a kid.
Sure.
And so I do have all these stories floating around in my head anyway. And I think ever since I was a kid, growing up as an Asian in a predominantly white suburb, things like that, I've always been looking for place, my place in the world, my place in Australia, my place in the universe. It's always been that kind of storyline to begin with. And so, for example, my images from Australia and from Tasmania, a lot of that is it's about having that thought to begin with about finding my place, and then what does place actually mean to me? And for me, Australia is about having the desert at your back, having the ocean in front of you. It's such a vast, beautiful place. And that's what I identify with. And so when I go out to take those photos, I'm trying to create that feeling of freedom, of vastness, of being alone in the landscape, but still, knowing where you are and where you belong. And so that's my overall story for my Australia images. But for example, when I traveled to Finland in 2016 and I took photos of snow-covered trees at Riisatunturi National Park, the storyline there was about the magical figures that could arise from the landscape, and utilizing the imagination to create a fantasy world. And so that story unraveled while I was there, while I was in that landscape, seeing these snow-covered trees that resemble giant monsters or giant wizards. But yeah, so the process is always different.
Yeah, cool. Do you think that background of writing has assisted you? It's clearly from the images that I've seen, the impact that they have, the emotion that they, or at least I derive from them. Do you think that a lot of your success with those images or in finalizing those images in the way that you have has come from your ability to communicate well?
Most definitely. I think one of the things that I really focus on with my photography is communication. Because you can take a beautiful picture, but if it doesn't appeal to people, if it's not communicating a message in a way that people can digest it, then it's not a successful image. And for me, writing is a way of communicating, and it's when I take my images, I've already got that story in my head, but I often communicate that story across my social media channels, for example, attaching captions to the images. And also, when I create a project, I write the synopsis that goes with that project. So that there is a lot to do with writing, but also about consuming other people's writing. For example, Tim Winton, one of my favorite Australian photographers, he's very visual in his writing. So he's not just writing, but he's creating a world in your mind. And for me, when I take photographs, I'm creating a visual photograph, but I'm wanting to create that story in your mind to go with.
So in terms of those stories and how they translate from the verbal or the audible or the written communication into the purely visual communication, what's your thought process around how you take that story and say, okay, that's the image that nails that piece of the story?
I think it's about the poetry within the story. I think when you write poetry, there's already a flow to it. There's already a sense of imagination that goes with it. And I know that I'm probably not unique in that sense that I can experience that and be able to weave that into an image. But when I think about that flow, I think about the flow in the image as well and the composition of the image. And so oftentimes, right, that there are elements within your composition that can flow with that story. And that's how you story tell with your images, using compositional elements, foreground, colors, patterns, that kind of thing. It's a bit difficult to put into words, I think, but I think for a lot of photographers, they already experience that.
As I say, it's one of the things that I'm really fascinated in is people that use, I've had many photographers on the show who are musicians, and their expression in music comes out in their visual communication, and kind of vice versa, where they compose their own music. They'll see a scene and have a photo in mind and then compose a piece around it. There's people I know that do poetry in alongside all of their imagery. And, you know, to me, it's just fascinating how those communication mediums are connected in people's minds and how they actually think about taking it from one communication mode to another.
Yeah, I find that fascinating as well. And like I said, communication has always been at the forefront of my images, particularly having worked, I used to work in psychiatry for a really long time. So communication was the main element of working in psychiatry. So for me, there are so many different ways that you can communicate, not just verbally. There's a lot of non-verbal communication that can be done. And particularly with art, that's a wonderful way for that non-verbal communication to manifest.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm also interested in, do you collaborate with other artists, such as painters or musicians, to do interdisciplinary projects at all?
I've done a little bit of that, and I'd love to do more because my scope of photography, I guess my scope of art isn't limited to photography. So I'd love to do more of that. At the moment, I'm trying to work on an audiovisual project, which I would like to expand to be a full sensory experience. I don't have all those skills to be able to do that. And I think it would be wonderful to collaborate with people that do have those skills, the engineering skills and the audio skills that are required.
Sounds awesome. What made you decide full-time photography was for you? Was it something that started very early on and it was just, this is me, this is what I've got to do? Or is it something that came a bit later?
I think I started photography really young, when I was 9 years old, and it became a professional thing when I was 17. So I started working in nightclubs and bars, being the house photographer.
Yep.
And I did that while I was studying, and I did that when I began working as well, after I finished university. And so even while I was working full-time in psychiatry, I was also working full-time in photography, just at the other end of the spectrum. So psychiatry during the day, photography at night. And it became a little bit too much after a while when I started getting older. Mm-hmm. There wasn't enough sleep. And so then it was one or the other. So I dropped back my hours in psychiatry. I started working part-time instead. And then eventually photography just took over. There wasn't room for both of them. So I chose photography because it was something that I was passionate about. And I just couldn't see myself in that cycle of psychiatry for so long, until the end of my days. So I took on photography full-time and resigned from psychiatry. And that was an experience in itself. It was super difficult to go from having a full-time career to suddenly struggling as
someone
else
is paying you, and now you've got to pay you. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Suddenly, your hard work doesn't necessarily lead to income. So,
sure.
Yeah, that was really difficult. And also living in a different country while I was doing that, and working freelance, not having an assured income, that was really scary. But I think I've started getting on top of it now, and the business is flourishing.
So yeah, they kind of say it takes about 5 years to get to a point where you can make money out of it, where you can, okay, I can actually live on this.
Yeah. Still trying to supplement income in different ways, not necessarily just taking photos, but selling the photos, teaching, mentorship, all that sort of stuff. So, it's a whole business model at work.
I think that's a really important point. A lot of people, when they first start out, they think, oh, yeah, I'm just going to dot around the landscape, take my photos, and I'll put them online and everyone will love them and buy them.
Yeah, it's not always the case. And I think there's maybe a saturation of workshops out there.
Absolutely.
And yeah, everyone's trying to run a workshop, and it's not a great way to make money, but it's a great way to travel, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you balance all of the different hats that you've got to wear? Because you're the artistic director, you're the CEO, you're the chief finance officer, you're the chief marketing officer, yada, yada. You're everything. Yeah. How do you balance that? You mentioned you'd spent a lot more time on the admin and that was starting to pay off for you. What kind of percentage of time do you think is the right balance for you?
Yeah, I think maybe I'm not so good at balancing it.
Okay.
When I am focused on the photography side of things, that's usually all I have time for. It takes a back step on that. When I'm shooting morning to night, sometimes during the night as well. Mm. And so there's no time for that. And usually I try and set aside a little bit of time during the day or in the morning where I work on things like emails, responding to people, responding to requests for licensing, things like that. And finances I deal with afterwards. So I have a big spreadsheet that where I work out my budget, and all of that gets done afterwards. That doesn't mean that I haven't budgeted for my trips. It means that I need that time afterwards to be able to budget for the next things.
Yeah.
So it's all about trying to find some time in between. And I'm not necessarily the greatest at responding to emails. Sometimes I leave a week before I respond, but I think it's about prioritizing as well.
Definitely.
Like you can usually tell when licensing requests come in or when email requests come in, what's more important. And I have a big list and I prioritize things on that list and tick them off when I've done them. So
maybe I
need a PA.
Someone will invent some AI that'll do all of that for you. I'm quite sure at some point. I wish. I think that would be marvellous, a bit of AI kit that would do all the admin and budgeting and all the spreadsheeting for you.
It probably already exists.
More than likely, somebody out there's probably done something.
Yeah, exactly.
I love what you said about the prioritisation, though, because I came from the corporate world, and to be honest, a lot of people let their email rule their world and it becomes all consuming. Oh, I've got to respond to this. I've got to do it now. And it gets this expectation that there's an immediate response. And I saw something the other day where rather than apologizing for not getting back to somebody, you should just thank them for their patience.
That's right. That's what I've been doing recently.
Awesome.
Yeah. I think we might have read the same thing.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. I usually set aside an hour in the morning and maybe half an hour in the evening to respond within a 9 to 5 time frame. So 9 o'clock in the morning, I'll respond to things. And right before 5 o'clock, I'll respond. And then that in itself is my admin time, and I won't look at it outside of that time. And if I'm responding in the last half hour before 5 o'clock, my response will be, I'll respond to you in the morning.
I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I'll get back to you. Thank you for your response.
Awesome. I think it's vital, whether you're a creative person or whether you're in the corporate world, I think it's absolutely vital to prioritize actually doing things as opposed to the busy work that email mostly is. Because, yes, I know for a creative, it's almost vital that you're getting back and you're getting pictures out to people if you're looking for commercial work or something like that. You've got to be able to communicate and get that turnaround happening, but it's also vital that you prioritize that. And I think that compartmentalization is a really key thing to it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You have to set aside time to be creative, and you can't be creative when you're thinking about paperwork.
No, of course not. Yeah. I know damn well when I get out in the field, nothing else matters. It's just, what am I seeing through the viewfinder? That's it.
Yeah, exactly.
And is that what I want to see?
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the things that many people struggle with in their photography careers, particularly freelancing and so forth, is pricing. Do you have any strategies around that, or is it stick a finger in the air and hope for the best?
To begin with, when I first started working as a music photographer, I had no idea how to price anything. So I just thought about my worth, what my time was worth, and what my camera equipment was worth, and just figured it out from there. Because in the end, you have to be able to pay your bills, feed yourself, yep, pay your rent, whatever, and pay for your gear. If some of it is broken, you need to be able to pay for the repair, that sort of stuff. So I would work it out according to that. A little bit later, I started getting an idea of the prices that other people were charging for their work and their time. And so then that would influence how I priced things as well. These days, there's so many of us working in photography, and I have a great network of friends who do work professionally in photography. There's a lot of communication about, oh, how much are you charging? And then you can structure your price list from there. But in terms of pricing for galleries, pricing things for sale in shops, that for me has been a bit of a touch and go process, because it's all about the value of your work, what people will pay for it. So since I started getting exhibited in galleries, pricing has been a bit more difficult to think about, because it's not necessarily in my control anymore. It's what the gallery wants to price. Yeah. And when a gallery places a price on something, that shifts the pricing of all of your other work as well, and the value of it. And suddenly you go from selling a lot of work in a short period of time to maybe selling only a few pieces of work over a longer period of time. So that is something to think about when you think about your price list.
Yeah, absolutely. And it might be even project-based. This particular project resonates with an audience more than the next one that you do. So you do project A and you might make some money out of that, and you do project B thinking, beauty, it'll be the same, and it's just not.
I've noticed a lot of my friends do a lot of stock photography. When we worked in music, we did stock photography. When we did documentary photography, we did a lot of stock. But now in landscape, I've noticed, and nature photography as well, a lot of my friends are doing stock photography. And I think that's great to have a passive income. Kind of keeps you going in the background when you're working on your more important projects.
Definitely. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the gallery experience. How did that start for you, and how's it going, and how are you working with gallery?
Yeah, so it started a few years ago after I placed in the Sony World Photography Competition with my architecture series. And so my work was picked up by a gallery in Berlin, and suddenly it was out there, it was being exposed next to other artists that were not necessarily photographers. I remember seeing my work being on auction next to Banksy, and it was an eye-opening, uncomfortable experience in a way, because you don't necessarily expect to see your work in a place like that, or to be compared to other artists like that. So it's been an interesting journey. Usually what galleries want is not necessarily what you think is good about your work as well, what people are looking for. And so that's been eye-opening in itself. But it's been an interesting journey, one that really, for me, it's quite fulfilling, because I've always wanted my work in a gallery. So for me to see my work in a gallery being evaluated, being a part of art history, that's really exciting. But it does have its impacts on other aspects of your photography. Like I mentioned, it changes the pricing of all of your work. It changes the demand. So I've been trying to exhibit in more galleries around the world. That's one of my goals. And I haven't cracked the USA yet. That's
Okay.
my goal, cracking a gallery in the USA. But yeah, exhibiting in Europe has been wonderful, and exhibiting in Asia as well.
Fantastic, fantastic. Where is your favorite spot to shoot? Is there a spot that keeps calling you back that you go, yep, I've got unfinished business there, I need to go?
Yeah, industrial areas. Like just aluminium smelters, steel recycling factories, concrete batching plants. That grittiness, the any area that's under construction really draws me in, especially when there's a surrounding landscape that is otherwise pristine. I think that may be difficult to find in other countries, like in Europe or Australia or the US, but I think it's something that is easier to find here in Iceland, maybe in Finland, maybe in Norway, definitely in Greenland, where you have this obvious human impact within an otherwise pristine environment. Those kinds of landscapes draw me in, and I feel that there's so much more to be experienced there and so many more stories to be told.
Okay. One of the things I'm really keen to understand with almost everybody that I speak to is that nexus between where you live, how you shoot, and what you shoot. So, how has Iceland influenced your photography and how you shoot?
I think when I first started out in landscape photography, it was all about finding a foreground and using wide angle lenses and trying to capture the immensity of the environment, the landscape that I was in. But since moving to Iceland, I've found that the landscape is so immense that you really need to focus on small parts of it. And so these days, I predominantly shoot with a telephoto lens. And I try to compact elements within the landscape into a single image. The landscape here, it's impossible to shoot an entire mountain, but you can, if you stand far enough away, then you can get that shot. Yeah, I've found myself shooting a lot with telephoto. And since doing architecture within the landscape, I found myself using a 24 to 70 a bit more often, but also shooting from a moving vehicle. So I often shoot from a moving vehicle, predominantly shoot from a moving vehicle. And that's because a lot of these areas that I'm shooting in have security that will tell you to move on if you
Yeah,
stop.
you stop and set up a tripod, you're gonna copy.
Exactly. So I need a getaway driver. So I've often got someone driving on a highway while I lean out of the window and take shots. So I've gone from taking single images to taking hundreds of shots that I focus stack. Yes, so it's been a different way of shooting that is more exciting, and you're not always guaranteed to know what you're going to end up with, but I think that's part of the process.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. For somebody that normally stands on a rock shelf doing seascapes in long exposures, it's a bit mind-blowing.
I've stopped doing so many long exposures now, and it's all about focus stacking.
Awesome. What's your most memorable experience out shooting?
I think it would have had to have been in the Dolomites a few years ago. It was a project for Adobe, and I was there with Michael Shane Bloom, and Andrew Studer, and I think we had hiked up to Trecime at nighttime. We started off early in the evening, and they were time lapsing. So we were there all night from sunset until sunrise. We time lapsed, and there was a meteor shower that we were unprepared. And the most gigantic meteorite that I've ever seen entered the atmosphere. And I remember all three of us standing there watching it just hanging in the air. Huge ball of fire, and it was one of the most amazing experiences. And then the sun came up, and it came up so slowly, everything went pink, and all three of us were crazy shooting in all different directions. And we had all our cameras set up. They were time lapsing with several cameras. Yeah, it was a beautiful experience.
Fantastic. What about horror stories? There's always one or two things that don't go quite right.
Yeah, I've got a couple, both in Iceland. I think, the main one was the first time I came to Iceland. I was shooting at Breiðamerkursandur, which I think most people know as the ice beach.
Yep.
And yeah, the wave came in, it splashed over the iceberg and took me out, took my camera out, and it washed everything out to sea. And so I didn't have a camera anymore. I didn't have a tripod anymore. And I still had, I think, 14 days left of my trip.
Oh, wow.
So I had to go back to Reykjavik. And back then there was only one camera store.
Mm-hmm.
And they only had one camera. And so that camera I had to buy. And that's the same camera that I'm working with now. I haven't upgraded since. Yeah, there was
so
no
choice.
You
never saw it again?
Yeah, never saw the other stuff again.
Oh, dear. How many shots did you buy?
I actually came back up with the memory card.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so I remember it all went under and I managed to save the memory card. And so I have the shot of everything going under. It's a long exposure of all the waves coming over.
I've got a couple of shots of my camera dying. I've changed the innards of it twice. Luckily, it's never been swept away. But yeah, my worst one was I had my 24-70 on the f2, and the tripod decided to fall over face forwards. So sitting there at a bit of an angle, the lens is now like this, and it just doesn't work anymore.
Oh wow, that's unfortunate.
What insurance is for though?
Yeah, and at least you've come out of it alive, I think.
Yeah. I try not to go anywhere that's too sketchy. I was clinging off a cliff the other night, which was a bit different. I was down at Camel Rock. I'm not sure if you've ever been down there, but there's a couple of tufts of grass that sort of sit about halfway up this sort of scrabbly cliff. There is a path up to it, but it's only about 6 inches wide. Balanced up there with the tripod legs splayed out, doing long exposures as the Milky Way rose over behind Camel Rock, which the shots turned out nice. So I didn't lose anything. It was all good.
That's good.
Yeah, I should have worn better footwear though. I was in my sandal.
Oh, Australia is the kind of place where you can do that though.
Yeah, it was a hot night, so I wasn't gonna encase my feet and shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you're out, do you prefer photographing alone or with other people? Sounds like you had a ball with Michael Shanebloom and Andrew.
Yeah, I love shooting with other people. There's so much that I can do when I'm alone, but when I'm with other people, I see how they're shooting as well. And we often talk out loud about what we're doing. And I think that's really inspirational in itself. So I love going on photo trips. When I shoot, I love to plan photo trips. I love to get a group of like-minded people together and shoot together.
Awesome.
And so this coming week, actually on Monday, I'm traveling to Tromsø in Norway to shoot with my friend Espen. And that's going to be fantastic. I already know it because it's a beautiful place and we've already planned a few things that we're going to shoot. So in my mind, I'm already in that mindset of it's going to be a whole week of creativity with someone else who loves to do that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think shooting with other people is a really great thing.
What have you learned about the world through photography?
That it's fleeting. It's fleeting and our memories are fleeting. We are fleeting. We're only here for a short time. Things go very quickly. And so that's the main thing that I've learned from photography, that we take pictures that capture moments that will hopefully last a bit longer than us and will tell a story or get a message across for a longer duration than we're around. I think that's the importance of photography, but that's really stood out for me since doing photography.
Yeah. I was going to ask where you saw photography in society, but I think that's a great answer to that.
Yeah. We've only been on this planet a short time, and photography has been something we've had in the last 120 years or so.
Blink of an eye. Yeah.
we're not really capturing that much, but hopefully we'll be able to leave a bit of a legacy with
them. Yeah, awesome. What's the future of photography?
I think of photography as lens-based art. For me, that's using any sort of lens to create an image. And I think that as photography evolves, we'll be seeing a bit more of that. Less of a camera encasing the lens, mm-hmm. and more of the lens becoming a fluid object within our environment that we can utilize and manipulate to capture things around us. Maybe the lens becomes part of our bodies. Maybe it becomes something that's implanted into us. And I see photography evolving in ways that has to match with the technology that we have. I think it's exciting, and I'm so excited to see where we go even in the next 20 years. It's evolved so much in the last 50 years.
Absolutely. What about challenges? What do you see as the biggest challenge facing photography at the moment?
I think it's maybe coming up with new ideas, new work. I think with the advent of AI, we consume a lot as photographers anyway. We go to galleries, we look at photo books, and that information is absorbed into our brains and it influences our creativity. With AI, we're actively feeding these things into the machine so that it learns. And then those machines are creating images that we then absorb from as well. Mm-hmm. And I think being original is something that's going to be really difficult. It's going to be a challenge that we're certainly going to see in the next few years, because we're not going to know what we're being influenced by anymore, whether that's something that's realistic or something that's been influenced by machine learning. And I think it's going to be a struggle to come up with new work in that aspect. But if you think about things like music, how music has evolved and changed, and sometimes you think, how else can it be different? And then people come up with new ways of it being different. I think that's a photography. We're going to find new ways to make it more original. And I'm just interested to see the people who come up with those ideas, how their thinking is going to be different, and how they'll be able to change art history and change the world in that aspect.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
Mm.
What do you think has been one of the things that you've noted within the landscape in Iceland in particular that has been the impact of people getting there, doing basically photo tourism? If you went back 10, 15 years, Iceland was visited a reasonable amount, but nothing like what it is now. It's an absolute photo magnet simply because it does have so many iconic locations. Have you noticed a change in the time that you've been there?
Definitely. When I first started coming here, the tourism was in place already, but there were places that you could access that didn't have fences. It was still pretty much in nature. Since then, and particularly since the pandemic, we've had an influx of tourism, and that's had a huge impact on the environment, particularly around certain waterfalls like Skógafoss, where they've had to erect fencing and ropes to make sure that people don't keep treading on the same path and eroding that environment. And there was a time when one of the canyons was closed for a short period because there was so much erosion from foot traffic that the cliff was basically falling away. Yes, that's the impact that I've seen since moving here. And it's always at the same locations because people want the pictures from the same locations. Even photographers, even people who are not necessarily photographers who are just on group tours, they also go to these same locations. And
they
look
amazing, so they want to see it. Yeah.
Exactly, but there's so much traffic in the same places having a huge impact on the environment. And then you have the people who don't respect closures, who don't respect the fences. It's crazy how photography has become so capitalized and such a consumerist activity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for me is very depressing. And so personally, when I teach photography, I don't teach in a tour sense. I like to teach more within a remote setting where I encourage people to do photography within their own environment in a more conscious kind
Fantastic. I'm
of.
interested in your process around processing. Are you straight back from shooting around in your car, madly taking photos, straight back into the studio, upload and into the edit, or do you leave them for a bit to marinate and think about before you get into the edit phase?
It depends. Usually, when I'm straight out of the car, I'm trying to back everything up so I don't lose it all.
Sure.
Then I'll have a quick look.
That's usually my priority too.
Then I have a quick look at what might have worked and what might not have worked, whether there are any money shots. And then I do a quick edit on the money shot to see what I can do with it. But then I usually let the images marinate for a bit. Usually over a few weeks, sometimes over a few months.
Okay.
I've had one that I left for a whole year. And then it's a process of doing different edits. So I'll work on it for a day intensely, applying different edits, saving different versions. And then I have to sleep on it because my eyes get tired and I can't necessarily figure out which one's the best anymore. And then I'll look at it the next day and decide what needs to be changed and which one's the best, basically.
Oh,
So,
okay. So you're not one of these people that just does 10-minute Lightroom bang. Great, great. Got
no, I
a
need time to
gradient
think
filter in
about
and happy days. That's all we need.
Yeah, no, usually if I'm just doing a quick edit, it'll be a vignette.
So that processing style of doing different versions, you're not the only person I've spoken to that does that, but it's not that often that I hear from photographers. Normally they go in, they have a bit of an idea about what they're going to do with it. They do that, or they have their workflow and they do that workflow. That's all they do. And so tell me a little bit about that process of thinking about an image in different ways, looking at it in different ways. What is it that you're looking for, and what is it that you're trying to actually do with the manipulation of the image?
So when I look at an image, I do apply some blanket workflow to it, and that's my style. Desaturating a little bit, taking away some of the blacks, taking away some of the highlights.
So.
So that's blanket kind of stuff. But then, particularly with my architectural work, I'm looking at elements that I can focus on, how I can. Sorry, there's a plane going.
That's okay.
Yeah, so I'm looking at what are the elements that stand out about the image, and how are those elements going to draw the eye through the image? And when I look at those elements, sometimes they can change within the image itself. So that affects how I burn and dodge things that I highlight. It affects how I saturate the image as well. And particularly with my architectural work, it affects how I change the colors of the image.
Right.
And so, with my architectural work, because I'm trying to create a narrative of being on a different planet, I go through several iterations of colors, different palettes, and that affects the atmosphere that I want to create. Yeah,
Cool.
so I'm always thinking about the story and how that image is going to play into that story.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. What's the best and or worst piece of advice you've ever gotten?
I think the best piece of advice I've ever gotten was from one of my lecturers, who's a documentary photographer. And he said, always use your feet. Never just plant your tripod, use your feet. And I think that's something that landscape photographers get really stuck in. You've got your tripod, you put it down, and that's where you're standing. That's your angle. You don't move your camera, that's it. And for me, it's been really important, particularly in documentary photography, which I've now applied to landscape photography, to take your camera before you even put it on your tripod and look at the landscape from different angles. Move around, use your feet, get closer, get further away, but use your feet to do it. Don't use your zoom. And when you've found the angle that you want, then you move your tripod under. That's the best piece of advice. I think the worst piece of advice, it's probably shoot weddings. Your income doesn't have to come from weddings. If you really hate doing something about photography, don't do it, because you're going to lose your passion for photography if you do that.
Yeah, I totally get it. I have a really good friend who spent a lot of time doing weddings and events and so forth. He now has dived in, he's stopped all of that, but he's now dived into a passion that he has for motorsport photography.
He
shoots for Porsche and the Audi team in the local sports car competitions around here, and they fly him all around Australia to...
Yeah, that's great. I think when you find your passion, try not to let anything take it away. Because once you start hating to do something, it becomes work. And when something's work, you don't want to go to it anymore.
Yeah, when it feels like work, it's probably not the right thing to be doing. Yeah.
Exactly.
Fair enough. Yeah. Have you got any photographers in mind? And I'm particularly interested in people that might not have got a lot of exposure out there that you think I should be talking to on the podcast.
Yeah. One of my favorite photographers, like I said, is my friend Espen Bergesen. He takes pictures of nature, wildlife, particularly whales. His work on whales is amazing. Yeah, he's very inspirational for me. But in terms of photography in general, Araya Laron, she's an Australian photographer. She actually lives in Hurstbridge, which is close to where I grew up. Her work is incredible. It's based on her experience of trauma and how she manifests that within her surroundings, her environment, and her landscape. Yep. Judith Nangala, her work is amazing.
Yep.
She's got this stunning body of work that it looks like a fairy tale. It doesn't look real. But she's constructed a lens within the environment that she uses to capture animals that some of them, I think, have passed away. And the images that she comes up with, they look like they're taken in space, but they're actually just in the bush. Yeah, it's amazing. Her work is absolutely stunning.
Fantastic. I've got one more question for you, and it's the question that everybody has on their lips. Do you like pineapple on pizza?
I love pineapple on pizza. And that's a conversation I've been having here in Iceland recently.
Really?
Because I mentioned that in Australia we have beetroot and pineapple on burgers.
Yeah.
That's a big no-no here. So do you like beetroot on your burgers?
Wow. No, I love a burger with the lot. And it's got to have both. Otherwise, it's not the lot.
That's right. It's got to be soggy.
And none of that bloody brioche bun, thank you.
No.
It's got to be that white buttercup seeded bun.
That's right.
Stick under the grill.
With the
Are you struggling to find that in Iceland? Right?
I'm struggling to find the soggy bun. but burger eating is a huge culture here in Iceland. Right. There's burgers everywhere.
All right. It's been wonderful having a chat with you, Serena, and thank you for spending some time with us to share some of your story. Where can people find your work?
On my website, serenaversusworld.com. So serenavsworld.com.
Mm-hmm.
Also on my Instagram. I think that's the place that I keep most updated.
Right.
So that's just at serenavsworld. Yeah, but otherwise, if you're heading to Europe, my work will be exhibited in Paris soon. I'm not supposed to say anything about that yet.
It's all right. This doesn't go out for a few weeks, so.
Oh, good. it's going to be happening in May. I've got an exhibition happening in Tokyo in March, as part of the Sony World Photography exhibition. And hopefully there will be a couple more exhibitions this summer in Europe. Yeah, we'll see. But also, if you visit Iceland, some of my work is being sold in the shops here. So yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Awesome. Thanks very much, Serena. It's been an absolute blast.
Thanks so much for having me, Grant. And yeah, thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening to Landscape Photography World. I hope you enjoyed the show and keep listening because I'll be joined by some great guests in upcoming episodes. You can find my work in this podcast at grantswinburnephotography.com. I'm also on Vero, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Grant Swinburne. Hope to see you out shooting soon.